You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Matthew chapter 8. You know, as we move on into this next section of the book of Matthew, I thought it might help just to kind of zoom out a little bit. I don't know if you're like me, but you know, if you're like me, you know, when you come to the Gospels especially, it kind of feels like completely random, like we're just pulling stories out of a hat and reading the next one when you read through these things. It's hard to see any sense of direction, any sort of structure or form at all. And so what I just wanted to show you kind of what Matthew's doing here in this part of the book. I don't know if you can just kind of rewind your brain several chapters back to Matthew chapter 4, verse 23, where Matthew makes this statement right here. He says, Jesus went throughout Galilee teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness among the people. You know, up till this point in the book, remember, he spent several chapters arguing for Jesus as the fulfillment of quite a number of Old Testament predictions and pictures. And that Jesus, you know, all of this was laid out long in advance, hundreds and even thousands of years in advance, through the Jewish scriptures, what is our Old Testament today. When Matthew then gets to this point here, what he does is he basically gives us an outline of the next five chapters of his book. First thing he's going to do, he's going to show us in Matthew 5 through 7, Jesus' authoritative teaching. Remember the Sermon on the Mount that we spent 8 weeks studying through? And remember the reaction of the crowds at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, where they were just amazed, they marveled at the authority that Jesus had. He was not like the teachers of their day. You know, the teachers of their day, they would quote this rabbi, they would quote that rabbi, they would quote that scribe. You know, or even the prophets that they would read would say, you know, the word of the Lord came to me and said this. Jesus said, forget it. I tell you this, speaking authoritatively, directly from God on these things. And so Matthew shows us an example of Jesus' teaching and preaching. And then in Matthew, in the next two chapters, he goes on to show us examples of Jesus healing every disease and sickness among the people in Matthew 8 and 9. You know, Matthew says, okay, you've seen what Jesus has to say. Now, wait till you get a load of what Jesus can do. And in order to get a glimpse of what Jesus can do, Matthew says, we're going to need a montage. And that's exactly what we get in Matthew 8 and 9. We get a block of 10 miracles that he drops right on us, not in any particular order. You know, there's some themes that run throughout these. They're not chronological. Some of them probably took place earlier in his ministry, certainly took place earlier in his ministry. But what he's trying to demonstrate here is he's trying to demonstrate, you know, on what grounds is Jesus declaring the things that he's declaring. And, you know, at the end of, right at the end of Matthew 9, Matthew 9, 35, Matthew repeats this verse right here, 4:23, repeats it almost word for word. It's kind of like a bookend around this whole section, showing the authoritative teaching and power of Jesus Christ. So, you know, we got 10 miracles, broken up into three chunks, and we're just going to spend each of the next 3 weeks looking at these miracles of Christ. Which means we need to talk about miracles. Miracle. Merriam-Webster defines it as an extraordinary event manifesting divine intervention in human affairs. And so we've got the normal laws of nature, cause and effect, and then you've got, like, a miracle is where something or someone from the outside kind of breaks into this closed system of cause and effect and causes something to happen. You know, there's no natural cause for it. It's some kind of supernatural or divine cause. And, you know, some people have a real problem with this because, you know, there's a worldview known as naturalism, or there's different names that this goes by, but it's basically the idea that there is no other cause other than natural cause and effect, that natural causes can account for and explain everything that is, everything that happens, everything that exists. And I think it's described pretty well, for example, in this article from Today, actually. It's an article about a new book coming out by Stephen Hawking, world-renowned physicist and cosmologist. You know, this guy wrote a book on physics that sold 9 million copies. He was also in several South Park and Simpsons episodes. Some of us may know him from there. But he's got a new book coming out, and it says in his 1988 book, A Brief History of Time, Hawking had seemed to accept the role of God in the creation of the universe. But in the new text, co-written with American physicist Leonard Laudanau, he said new theories showed a creator is not necessary. Because there's a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing, he writes. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing. Why the universe exists, why we exist. So you can see here, there's certain laws that govern the universe, and he's trying to argue that those in and of themselves are sufficient to account for everything, possibly even these laws themselves, something he calls spontaneous creation. And he goes on to say the fact that we human beings, who are ourselves mere collections of fundamental particles of nature, have been able to come this close to an understanding of the laws governing us and our universe is a great triumph. And so, you know, the naturalist, the philosophical materialist, in other terms, he says, you know, we are mere collections of fundamental particles of nature. You know, if all that exists is matter, there is no spiritual dimension, then that's exactly what we are. We're basically, you know, kind of skin sacks with chemicals and juices, chemicals reacting to one another. The way we got here was, you know, a series of chemical reactions in the first place. It wasn't like there was some designer. It wasn't like someone decided to do this. There was no choices involved. It's just a simple matter of chemicals reacting with one another. And so this is a position known as naturalism, and this position would argue that there is no such thing as miracles. And some of us come to the Bible pretty skeptical about the miracles that we see contained therein. I want to point out just a couple problems with that worldview. Okay, for one, it's an arrogant claim to omniscience. It's a claim to know everything. What the naturalist is claiming is not that, you know, there are some things that we can know, some things we can measure, some things we can track. We can actually measure quite a few things. What the naturalist is claiming is that it is impossible for there to be any other cause other than a natural cause. That there is no supernatural, nothing above or beyond the natural, nothing divine, no God, no deity or deities, and nothing that intervenes with this system of cause and effect. Now, why is this an arrogant claim to omniscience? Well, think about it this way. If you had to answer, if someone asked you, what percentage of all possible knowledge do you think you know? You know, all the knowledge that can be known of all events, facts, laws, theories, happenings, past, present, and future. What percentage do you think you know? Would you say 1%? Would you say, you know, maybe 10% would be a really generous estimate there. Hopefully none of us would say, I know 100% of everything. That would be really arrogant. I don't know how to talk to you if that's what you're saying. Actually, I would say, what am I thinking right now? And then whatever you say, I would say, not that. You've got an arrogant claim to omniscience here. So, you know, let's give you the benefit of the doubt and say you know 25% of everything that could possibly be known. Now, what you're really claiming is in the 75% you don't know, that there's no possibility that anything supernatural could exist or take place in the remaining 75% of the knowledge that I don't know. I think that is a huge leap of faith. To claim something like that. I don't think, you know, people that take this worldview realize what a giant leap of faith they're taking to claim, to know that there is no such thing as the supernatural and that the only things that exist are what I can measure with my five senses or, you know, equipment that I can produce as well. It's pretty arrogant, claim to omniscience. Also, there's no proof or evidence for this worldview. You know, like I said, you can track, you can measure a lot of things scientifically. But, you know, the claim that there is no such thing as the supernatural, and that if there is, that it could never enter, it or he or she or whatever could never intervene in the natural order of events, there's no proof for that. You know, you could prove it if it did happen, you know, that would be evidence, proof that it could happen. But, you know, even if it's never happened up until this point, how do you know that it's not going to happen tomorrow? It's not going to happen the next day? It's not going to happen after you die? That's a big question. What is going to happen when we die? What's going to happen when the material part of me is decomposing? Is there another part of me, a spiritual part? Am I more than just mere particles, fundamental particles, a collection of fundamental particles of the universe? There's no proof or evidence for this. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean that it's not there. I mean, you might think you don't have bed bugs in your house, but I know some of us have been in for a real big surprise in that area recently. No proof or evidence for this. Also, this is impossible to live out, and I think it's because we know that it isn't true. Francis Schaeffer has done a lot of writing on this, and I've been reading some of that lately. And you know, he was telling about this conversation he had with a scientist friend of his, who was, you know, a real brilliant guy, was, you know, on the cutting edge of a lot of discoveries. You know, he's talking to him about a recent discovery, and he said, "Okay, so you know, this is fine. This is all well and good for you as a Christian because you believe that yes, there is a natural world of cause and effect, but there also is a supernatural component, that we are spiritual beings and that there's more than just the physical." He said, you know, what do your scientist friends do when they go home at night? And he said, they have to live their lives as complete contradictions. They live their lives in a dichotomy. You know, they, on the one hand, they claim that we are just matter, that we are just, a lot of particles just kind of glom together. And yet he says, you know, to say that I'm only machine is one thing. To live consistently as if this were true is quite another. He says, the very mannishness of man refuses to live in the logic of the position to which his humanism and rationalism has brought him. It's what he calls the mannishness of man. The fact that we know that, you know, I am different than, you know, the equivalent, you know, my body weight in dead flies, you know. If you took a bag of dead flies equivalent to my body weight and put it on a scale, and then I stepped on that same scale, would you conclude that we're, you know, no real difference between us? You know, maybe, and if you're a naturalist, on what basis would you even argue for a difference between me and them? The fact that I'm a little more complex, that I've got a little more calcium, I've got some bones in me. He says, you know, the fact that we know deep down that we're different, we cannot live out this position consistently. And he gives several examples. One example he gives is love. And we've got to ask ourselves, am I prepared to accept the proposition that love is completely meaningless? That ultimately I'm completely meaningless. That, you know, one day I'm just going to decompose and turn into something else. You know, eventually all of this is going to decompose and turn into nothing. You know, when it comes to love, he points out Freud. He says, Freud, not really believing in love, saying that the end of all things is sex, yet needing real love, writes this to his fiancée. He says, "When you come to me, little princess, love me irrationally." When dorks talk dirty, this is what you get. But he's basically caught in this tension, this paradox, where on the one hand, he doesn't want to believe that love means anything, and yet deep down he knows that it does. He says, Freud, at this particular place comes what I would call a shuddering standstill. He is damned by what he is, by the emotions or real love in himself, because he has been made in the image of God. You see, these are the kind of arguments I go back to when I start to have doubts. To realize that the Christian worldview is the only worldview that can possibly be lived out. It's the only livable worldview. And that if we try to take any other, like this one right here, we run into all these contradictions, all these problems. You know, it's like we're torn within ourselves. We say one thing, but then we act as though it weren't even true. And so this position of naturalism, you know, even in that article by Hawking, you know, he's saying, you know, I think this is really awesome. What a great discovery. What great progress we're making, considering we're just, you know, collections of fundamental particles of the universe. You know, it's like he's trying to inject meaning into something that deep down doesn't have any. You know, the real question we got to ask is this one right here. Might God exist? If we're honest with ourselves, the answer to that question has got to be, yeah, he might exist. Unless I'm not going to claim that I know he doesn't. Am I going to arrogantly claim omniscience? Or am I willing to open myself up to this question? Because that question right there, that's a pretty important question. And if the answer to that question is yes, which it should be, we've already left naturalism. We've already opened the possibility that maybe there's something else out there, something that's not just a physical cause and effect, something more, something supernatural. And the next step would be to try to make contact with the God who might be there. You know, what question could be more important than this one right here? Because if there is a being standing outside of the natural order of things, there's a chance we're going to have to stand before that being someday. When our physical body runs out, if we do have a spiritual component, we may be standing before God someday. And God might have some questions for you. Like, how come you never tried to seek him out? Like, how come you never tried to make contact with him? Especially if the Bible is true, which says that God has gone to great lengths to intervene in the present order of things and to make himself known, to reveal who he is to us, and that he had a very specific message he wanted to communicate to us. That's the real question. As Christians, we would say, you know, we're not denying all cause and effect. You know, it's not like we put a pot of water on the stove and it starts boiling. We're like, whoa. It's a miracle. No, not at all. But, you know, we're open to the idea that God could intervene at points. I just don't think we have any ground for ruling this out. And so when we come to these miracle accounts in the Bible, it may raise another question as well, which is, why does God do miracles and why don't they happen more often? You know, that's another good question. You know, it seems like in the Bible there's all these big miracles, and then today it's like, you know, well, I prayed, I lost my car keys, and I prayed, and then I found them. Well, praise the Lord. You know, too bad that arm I lost isn't growing back. I've been praying about that too. You know, why are all the miracles things that could basically be explained away anyway? At least a lot of the ones that Christians claim today. And, you know, why don't they happen more often in our lives? That's a great question. You know, one thing we got to notice here is some key differences. You know, we got to notice something about the nature of biblical miracles. There are key differences from the biblical accounts of miracles and from other ancient miracle stories. You know, you think about examples of other ancient, you know, miracle stories, you know, like dipping Achilles in the river Styx so he's invincible all over, or, you know, weird fairy tales like a frog turning into a prince or a prince turning into a frog. You know, in the Bible, there's no potions, there's no magic wands, there's no dancing, there's no relics, there's no chanting, there's no special outfits that you have to put on. You're not drawing, you know, magic symbols in the ground, cutting yourself, hurting yourself to try to force the gods into doing what I want them to do. It's totally different when you come and you look at the biblical accounts of miracles. It's very simple. You'll notice this over the next several weeks, is just how simple it is. How there's not really any buildup. It almost seems too easy. It's a lot different than these. Also, another difference is they're set in real history. This is not set at the River Styx. This is not set, you know, in a galaxy far, far away. This is set in real historical places, mentioning real historical people, people that we have abundant records of from secular history of this time. And so, you know, it's like they believe these actually happened. This is not mythology. This is real. And another difference is that with the biblical miracles, they're not arbitrary. They're not to, like, give some sort of advantage to the person performing the miracle. They're designed to make a point, a theological point. They're designed to teach. One thing you'll notice is that there's clusters of miracles at key turning points in God's plan. Like, you know, this period of the time of Christ and the period shortly after Christ. You think about key points, if you've read your Old Testament, there's key points, key transition points. You know, you would think, some people think the Bible is just like a miracle on every page. And I mean, I guess the fact that God is revealing something is miraculous, but, you know, there'll be several centuries that'll go by sometimes without any record of any sort of miracle. But then a certain period will come along and there'll just be a bunch recorded right in a row. What God is showing there is he's showing, I'm heading a new direction here, and he's authenticating this direction, personally and supernaturally. Another thing you see is God's superiority and protection, and there's times where God has to protect his people. You know, you'll see sometimes Israel will get invaded or whatever in the Old Testament. They'll turn to God, and God will personally defend his people. like he promised that he would. You know, especially in ancient times when they would invade another nation, they would view it as their gods going to battle with each other. And God would just say, look, just stand right there and watch while I defeat this army without you having to do a thing. There's many, many occasions like that, just supernatural victory. Or one of God's, you know, God will have a leader or something like that that he needs to validate, or a message that he needs to validate. And so he'll do supernatural things to validate that leader, to validate the message that's being spoken, whether it's telling the future, whether in some cases interpreting dreams in a supernatural way. Also, sometimes it's just to help people. You'll see Jesus will have compassion on this person and he will heal them. He really felt for the suffering around him. And you see this in Old Testament prophets as well, like Elisha and Elijah. Now, even as he's helping people, he's still making some other points too. He's still making some other points along the way. Even as he helps them, yeah, other points too. There's a message that's being communicated there. We'll kind of point some of these out as we go along here this evening and over the next couple of weeks. But these miracles that we're looking at, I think there's two main things going on here. One, it's validating Jesus by demonstrating his authority. Remember, that's where we left things at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, as they were marveling, they were astonished at the way he was teaching with authority. And now, you know, Matthew's going to go on to show how Jesus demonstrated that authority through the supernatural. I mean, imagine if Jesus shows up and he's like, I'm the Son of God, and he's teaching all this new radical material, and he can't do any miracles. You know, it'd be a lot harder to believe that this guy is the real deal. You know, if somebody walked in here today and claimed to be the Son of God and they couldn't do anything, then I wouldn't really pay much attention to what they're saying. Now, if they turn and they take somebody that I've known since birth and who's had some sort of debilitating paralysis, puts his hand on him and says, brother, you're healed, and the guy gets up and starts dancing around, well, then all of a sudden, I'm going to sit up and take notice and wonder what is going on. I'm still going to be a little skeptical, especially because the claim he's making is so great, but I'm going to pay a little more attention. Stack enough of these up on top of each other, and I may start to become a believer, especially when you've got, like Matthew's been arguing, millennia of fulfilled prophecy for Christ. You know, if Jesus couldn't do any miracles, then we shouldn't believe in him. You know, ultimately the resurrection, one of the greatest miracles in the entire life of Christ and in all of Scripture. You know, Paul says if that didn't happen, then our faith is worthless. We're pitiful. And so these miracles, they're validating Jesus by demonstrating his authority. We also see that, you know, at the end of this section of miracles, at the beginning of chapter 10, it says that Jesus, he imparted authority to his disciples to do miracles, to go out, to preach, to teach. And he sends them out and he gives them some instructions as he sends them out. So part of what this is doing is he's also showing his disciples the kind of authority that he has, and that he has a right to give that over to them. And so, let's just start reading here. Matthew chapter 8. Miracle number one, the leper. First miracle recorded by Jesus here in Matthew. It says, when he came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. So Jesus was pretty popular by the time he got done with his block of teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. And it says, a man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean. Well, leprosy was a pretty bad disease to have back then. It's pretty gross. You know, we still do have some leprosy today, even though it is treatable. There's leper colonies. I think India alone has over 1,000 leper colonies. So in poorer parts of the world where they just don't have access to medical treatment, leprosy is still a problem. It's a skin disease. It's highly contagious. It's kind of like boils that form at or below the skin level. It also attacks the nerves. And you can lose feeling. You can actually lose entire limbs. I don't know if you guys have ever seen any pictures of leprosy, but you should Google that sometime. I was actually going to make some leper jokes, and I started looking at pictures of leprosy, and I was like, I don't think I can do that in good conscience. It's really disgusting. And, you know, they were quarantined from society because it was so highly contagious. Now, leprosy was kind of their term for any skin disease because they couldn't diagnose it that precisely. They couldn't say, well, this is, you know, a particular bacteria that causes leprosy. So this guy either had leprosy or a pretty bad skin disease such that he was quarantined from the rest of society. They were outside the city, and they had to ring a bell if people started coming near and shouting, "Unclean, unclean," so that people wouldn't accidentally stumble across them and contract the disease themselves. And so here Jesus somehow comes face to face to a man with leprosy. I'm not sure how he got so close to Christ with the large crowds around him. Could have been a downtime for him. It could have been he just came ringing his bell, walking right toward the crowd. And, it's kind of a game of chicken at that point, chicken with the leper. Another option, though, one I kind of like, and this is, speculative, but, I kind of envision Jesus walking with the crowd, and, the leper starts ringing his bell and shouting unclean. And I kind of envision the crowd just parting, but Jesus continuing to walk right toward this guy. Which would have been pretty shocking, a guy who had probably never been that close to a human being, had almost certainly never had physical contact with a healthy human, for Jesus to walk right up to this guy. And he kneels before Jesus and he says, "Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean." And then Jesus does the unthinkable. Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. And he said, "I'm willing, be clean." And immediately he was cured of his leprosy. A man who perhaps had never experienced physical touch, at least not intentional physical touch, from a healthy person before. And here you have the new celebrity, Jesus, walking right up to him, just clasping him on the shoulder. It says in Mark's account that the reason he did this is because he was so filled with compassion for this man. He just saw a hurting, lonely, outcast soul who probably didn't even feel like a human the way he'd been treated his whole life and probably the way he looked. And Jesus says, "Be clean," and he healed him. And Jesus said to him, "See that you don't tell anyone, but go show yourself to the priests and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them." This is actually prescribed in the Old Testament. If your skin disease did clear up, you're supposed to go to the priest to offer a special sacrifice to ceremonially cleanse you. And so Jesus sends him off to the priest. He says, "Don't tell anybody." Now, unfortunately, he actually did end up telling a lot of people, according to Mark. That resulted in such a rise in Jesus' popularity that he couldn't hang out in the cities anymore because he kept getting mobbed by the local peasants there. But what can we learn from this right here? Well, I think one thing that we see here is Jesus' authority. It's interesting. You read miracle accounts other places in the Bible, and somebody will come to maybe the prophet and ask for something, and he'll say, "I don't know, I got to go pray. I'll go talk to God about this." And they'll pray, and they'll go back, and they'll do whatever God told them to do. Can you interpret my dream? I don't know. God is the one that interprets dreams. Let me go pray. I'll get back with you tomorrow. This guy goes up to Jesus, and he says, "Can you heal me?" And Jesus is like, "Yeah, sure." And just does it. You see that it really, it's not deflecting, "Oh, it's not me. God's the only one that heals." Jesus is like, "Yeah, I'll heal you, buddy," and puts his hand right on him and heals the guy. It was his call, and it's his, his authority is being demonstrated here. God the Father has given Jesus this kind of authority to perform this kind of miracle. You also see a message for the priests in this. He says, "Go and show this to the priest," not as kind of like a "screw you, look at me, look what I can do," but more of like a, this was actually a testimony to the priest. He wanted them to believe. The high priests we see in Scripture and the heads of the priest caste and the religious leaders did not believe in Christ, but we learn in the book of Acts chapter 6 that actually quite a number of the priests were coming to faith, probably because of instances like this. So here you see an act of compassion on this man, also making a statement about who Jesus is, also being used as a witness, as a testimony, to tell other people who Jesus was. And one final point, the leper was an outcast. I think it's pretty fascinating that the first thing that Matthew records is Jesus healing an outcast of society. You kind of see this theme all the way back as we saw at the beginning of Matthew. In Jesus' genealogy, recording the outcasts, recording the losers, recording the sinners, knowing that he himself had a whole lot in common with this leper. An outcast of society, and highlighting that Jesus came not just to the outcasts. Jesus loves everyone. And yet the outcasts, because nobody else loves them, seem to be a whole lot more receptive to his love. We see him heal a centurion's servant. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. Now, we know that at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he moved to Capernaum. He was living in Nazareth. He moved to Capernaum. Peter also had a home there. It's possible that Jesus was staying with Peter, who was one of his disciples. So this is where Jesus lived. So he would have had probably maybe some regular dealings with the centurion. And actually, a lot of these miracles take place in Capernaum. The centurion came to him asking for help. Now, a centurion was a Roman soldier in charge of 100 soldiers. Capernaum was a kind of, they were not Roman troops on Palestinian soil here, but they would actually have troops from the surrounding areas as part of the Roman garrison. And so it was kind of like other local troops that they would hire that would be stationed here. And so this is a centurion that came to him asking for help. So this guy was not a Jew. This guy was a Gentile. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering. So he had a servant back at home, was suffering some sort of palsy, paralyzed, was in a ton of agony, and he's asking Jesus for help with this situation. Jesus said, I will go and heal him. The centurion replied, though. He said, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. Just say the word and my servant will be healed. So he says, no, don't come to my house. He says, I don't deserve, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. Just say the word, you know, from a distance. He says, for I'm a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. And that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus heard this, he was astonished. And he said to those following him, I tell you the truth, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. And this is one of only two times in all the Gospels that Jesus is amazed. The other time he was amazed at how little faith they had in his hometown of Nazareth. He tried to go there and do some teaching, and they were like, you're nothing special. Here, though, he's amazed in the other direction. He's amazed at how much faith this guy has. It's a little hard to tell at first. What's so astonishing? What's so amazing about this guy's faith? You know, it's like he made some military analogy, and that just blew Jesus away. Well, for one, he mentions Jesus' authority. Insight into Jesus' authority. You know, it's like he had some sort of penetrating insight into the sort of authority that Jesus had. You know, understanding the military structure helps a little bit here, actually. D.A. Carson writes, all authority belonged to the emperor and was delegated. So, you know, the whole army kind of, you know, the emperor delegated authority to certain generals who delegated authority to people under them, who delegated authority to their people under them. Eventually, it got down to the centurion. He says, therefore, because he was under the emperor's authority, when the centurion spoke, he spoke with the emperor's authority, and so his command was obeyed. A foot soldier who disobeyed would not be defying a mere centurion, but the emperor, Rome itself, with all its imperial might and majesty. You see, you know, there was a direct chain of command, a direct line that went straight up to the emperor and Rome itself. You know, his commands were backed up by the power of Rome and by Caesar. And so what he's saying to Jesus is, I understand your authority. He says, you know, I know how authority works. You know, the centurion was a representative of the emperor who had been granted authority from the emperor through a chain of soldiers. And what he understood was that Jesus got his authority direct from God the Father, who had authority over all disease, over all sickness, over any possible power that could oppose man or God. He understood, you know, you don't need to be present. You don't need to touch the person. You don't need to see the person. All you need to do is say the word, and my servant will be healed. So he had some incredible insight into the authority that Jesus had. This was not a mere man. This was not a mere prophet. This was someone who was working with the direct authority of God the Father, the emperor of all that exists. Another astonishing thing about this is that as a Gentile, as a non-Jew, he had a whole lot less light. He had a whole lot less exposure to the scriptures, a whole lot less exposure than the Jews around him had. And he says, this guy barely knows anything about the scriptures, which foretold me. And he's got this kind of faith. He says, I've yet to find this kind of faith anywhere else. I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith as this guy right here. Blown away. Another interesting thing here is he realized how unworthy he was to receive anything from Jesus. You know, he wasn't just saying, I'm a Gentile, you can't come into my house, but he says, I don't deserve it. I am unworthy to receive anything from you. He didn't come up and be like, don't you know who I am? I'm a centurion. I got power. Don't you know what I can do to you if you don't listen to me? You know, or aren't I such a good person trying to help out my servant? He just said, look, I don't deserve anything. I don't even deserve to have you come into my house. Please, just say the word, and my servant will be healed. That's the attitude you got to have if you're going to come to God in faith. Not an attitude of entitlement, not threatening God, but coming to him and admitting, God, I'm completely unworthy. And yet I know you have total power, and that you're the kind of God that doesn't bless those that are worthy, but only can bless those, only can give to those who are unworthy. That's the kind of person that I am. It comes with empty hands, not a $20 bill. And says, God, please, I need a hand out here. Jesus turns. He begins lecturing his followers. He says, I say, many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, the forefathers of the Jewish nation. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jesus keeps bringing up the hell thing. But he says, you know, there's going to be this huge banquet at the end. Everybody's going to be rejoicing when I finally set up my kingdom. And Abraham's going to be there, and Isaac's going to be there, and Jacob's going to be there, and there's going to be a lot of their physical descendants that aren't. Judaism had become an ethnic religion by this time, where people felt like, because I'm a Jew, I get into heaven. I get into the kingdom. And Jesus is like, no. No one's entitled to anything. Everyone needs to come to me by faith for grace. And so the centurion this whole time is like, so Jesus, what about my slave girl? So Jesus turns back to him. He said to the centurion, go. It will be done just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that very hour. The very hour that Jesus had commanded it to be done. And so Jesus heals the centurion's servant, again, an outcast. You know, you got a Gentile here, and then a Gentile slave. It's interesting, the Pharisees, each morning, they would pray this prayer. I give thanks that I'm a man and not a woman, a Jew and not a Gentile, a free man and not a slave. Well, who's he healed so far? A leper, who didn't make the top three, but probably would be number four. A Gentile slave. Well, now if we could just find a woman, we could complete the trifecta here. And that's exactly what Matthew records for us next, Peter's mother-in-law. Jesus came into Peter's house. He saw Peter's mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she got up and began to wait on him. When evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all the sick. This healing took place during the Sabbath. That's probably why people didn't show up until right when evening hit, because that's when the Sabbath ended. They'd probably heard that he had healed Peter's mother-in-law, and there was a line around the door for sundown on the Sabbath. And he begins healing all the ones that came to him. There's some exorcisms here, and also healing the sick. This is not just demonic possession. Notice the distinction between, you know, physical healing and also demonic. They didn't just think all sickness means you have a demon. And so Peter's mother-in-law, it seems less spectacular than the other two. I guess it was probably meaningful for Peter, though, since it was a close family member, his wife's mom. Also, you know, if she was older, you know, a fever could mean any number of things. You never know what that's a symptom of. And so that could be pretty scary. You know, that could turn a lot worse. And so he heals this woman. Instantaneously, she's able to get up and start waiting on him. This is not one of those healings where they pray for somebody and a week later their cold goes away and they claim this was the power of God. This was instantaneous, complete recovery. But, you know, this kind of blossomed out into a huge time of healing that evening of many different people in that city and in that region. And Matthew says, this was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and carried our diseases. So once again, we've got yet another fulfilled prediction. This referring to the ministry of Christ, that this would be a ministry of healing. where he is healing our sicknesses, our diseases, carrying our infirmities. But you know, this is really part of Jesus' larger mission. You know, Jesus came, yes, to heal. But ultimately, the whole reason there's disease in the first place is because of human sin. And God never intended for there to be disease, death, any of that in this world that he created. It was good. It was perfect when he created this. He didn't mean for us, spiritual beings, to die. What happened was the first humans rebelled against God's authority, broke our connection with him. And God had warned them, the day that you rebel against me, you will surely die. And that's exactly what happened. We were cut off from God spiritually because of our rebellion, because of what the Bible calls sin. And we also began to experience physical death at this point, not to mention alienation in all of our relationships and a seeming inability to get along with people. And so this is really part of the larger mission that Jesus came to deal with. He came ultimately to deal with sin, and disease is a byproduct of that sin. You know, so he did some healing during his ministry. I believe he still does healing today. I believe it's something we can ask for. I've definitely prayed for that many times, for myself, for other people. It's not a promise to heal all of our illness, all of our sickness. But it is, Jesus did promise that one day he would completely do away with all maladies, with all illness, and ultimately with death. And it's all because he dealt with sin, which is the root problem, which is the vehicle by which disease was brought into the world and now affects all of us. You know, this is what he says in Isaiah 53. It was our weaknesses he carried. It was our sorrows that weighed him down. And we thought his troubles were a punishment from God, a punishment for his own sins. He was pierced for our rebellion, crushed for our sins. He was beaten so we could be whole. He was whipped so we could be healed. All of us, like sheep, have strayed away. We have left God's paths to follow our own, yet the Lord laid on him the sins of us all. You see, Jesus came to take the punishment that we deserve for our sins, and God laid on him the sins of us all. The whole reason that he came. And everything else that he did was to prove who he was and to validate his mission and to call people to place their faith in him, their trust in him alone, to deal with their sin and with their guilt and with their separation from God. He came so people could join that banquet and not be cast into the outer darkness. So in conclusion here, I think it's pretty cool that Jesus' first three miracles recorded by Matthew were all directed toward outcasts. And he actually picked up two outcasts in one miracle by doing a Gentile slave at the same time. Is that the kind of love we have? Do we love the outcast? Do we love the overlooked? We should learn from Jesus on that one. That's the kind of love that he brought to this world. These miracles authenticated him and showed his authority. They showed who he was. Not just the fulfillment of all these predictions, not just teaching like nothing they've ever heard before, but also backing it up with display of power. This demonstrated his authority to make the claims that he was making. I think it's pretty cool that his power is expressed in love. He's not like we would do, where you have power and you use it to get something for yourself. He was doing just the opposite. He was using his power so he could give the love of God to people, unleashing a power in people's lives that is the solution to their problems, ultimately the solution to their sin, and gives them the power to deal with anything that life brings at them. And you got to understand, he wants to express his love to you. This power, this powerful love that he demonstrates here, he wants to unleash this in your life. The question is, are you willing to give him a shot? Are you willing at least to turn to him and say, God, if you're there, I want to know you. Please reveal yourself to me. Are you willing to look a little deeper into the claims of Christ? I encourage you to come back. Stick with us for the study of Matthew. God, thanks that you came to earth and that you made it super clear who you were, who you are, and what you came to do. Thank you that we've got record of that preserved and that we can sit here tonight and we can read this and we can experience you know, even some of the things that they experienced right there. Thanks, Lord, that our experience of you, though, is not just what we read in this book, but that we can have a personal encounter with you. And I pray that many of us here tonight, Lord, who have never experienced your love, that we might experience that for the first time ever. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.